is Monday, January 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Russia denounces U.S. claims that Moscow interfered in the presidential election.
Basically, the Kremlin is very tired of being accused of being involved in hacking in the U.S. election.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad says his forces are on the road to victory, and we hear how female musicians try to balance the challenges of raising a family while performing. It's all ahead. The Kremlin is denouncing as baseless and amateurish U.S. intelligence claims it meddled in the U.S. presidential election to help Donald Trump win a four-year term in the White House. A U.S. intelligence report was released Friday saying that Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an influence campaign on the election with a preference for Trump over his challenger Hillary Clinton. I spoke with VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf about the Russian response.
Well, today the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters that the allegations coming out of the U.S. intelligence community are unfounded, not based on any evidence, that it's all part of a big witch hunt, a very emotional and amateur effort on their part. These are words that Peskov used to describe the report that was released to the public last week. And that they're becoming tiresome, these kinds of accusations. Basically, the Kremlin is very tired of being accused of being involved in hacking in the U.S. election. Of course, this has been in the media quite a bit, not only in the U.S., but anytime there's an accusation that gets a lot of play against the Kremlin or against President Putin specifically, as this latest hacking report has indicated, then, you know, of course, there's going to be a reaction here in Moscow. And that reaction is inevitably to deny it and to reject it.
Well, yes. And recently, President Obama expelled 35 Russian diplomats from the United States because of the hacking. However, Moscow said it is not going to reciprocate because of that.
Yeah, that's right. And the expelling of the Russian diplomats was not directly because of the hacking. It was more because of the way that American diplomats, according to the U.S. government, have been treated here in Russia. But it was tied in with the sanctions that the Obama administration announced in regards to the hacking. So it was put into that whole package. But one of the big concerns that the Obama administration has raised, as we've seen tensions between the two countries and between Russia and the West in general, and relations falling apart after the situation in Ukraine and Russia's annexation of Crimea, has been the way that U.S. diplomats have been treated. The U.S. has raised allegations that they've been harassed at a much higher level in the last couple of years than they have in the past, a lot more surveillance. And we also had an incident, of course, this last summer where there was what the U.S. said was a U.S. diplomat who was trying to enter the embassy, and he was tackled by a Russian security guard at the embassy, who, of course, Russian security guards at the embassies work for Russian security services. The Russians accused him of being a spy, and so there was all this back and forth with that as well. So there's been, of course, a lot of tension, and the hacking allegations are one thing that the Kremlin has not been happy to hear about, and they've been continually rejecting.
Also, apparently, Daniel, today, Mr. Putin's spokesman discussed a possible meeting between Mr. Putin and President-elect Donald Trump.
Yeah, there's been a lot of speculation about when this is going to happen, a direct meeting between President-elect Trump and President Putin. There was some thought that it could happen even before President-elect Trump's inauguration, but the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, today said that there will definitely not be any kind of direct meeting until Trump takes office in the United States, and any kind of contact between Putin and Trump would have to be planned out very carefully, according to Peskov, because of all of the tensions that we've seen in the last couple of years, the way relations have gone downhill in the last couple of years. So it's something that they're looking forward to planning, but he said at this point there is no contact between Trump's team and the Kremlin, and no plan for exactly when it will take place, but that at some point there will be a meeting, some kind of direct contact between Putin and Trump after President-elect Trump is inaugurated at the end of this month.
That's VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's going on?
Well, just as in the news, there is a lot of talk on social media about that Russian hack of the U.S. presidential election. And perhaps we should use the language of the U.S. intelligence agencies. In that report last week, they called it, quote, an unprecedented Russian influence campaign. So clearly not just cyber. Whatever we call it, it's clearly a topic that is getting a lot of attention on social media and will be one that we're expecting to hear a lot of this week on Capitol Hill. We have no fewer than 9 Trump cabinet appointees who will have their nomination hearings this week alone, in addition to an expected Trump news conference and a farewell address by President Obama. So the first two up, former Senator Jeff Sessions for Attorney General and retired General John Kelly, who's the nominee to be Secretary of Homeland Security, expect to hear lots and lots of questions about Russia coming up there.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Senator Ted Cruz and the governor of Texas meet with the president of Taiwan. Hollywood jokes about President-elect Donald Trump, but actress Meryl Streep doesn't. 4 Pakistani activists critical of the government and radicalism are missing, and the U.S. Navy fires warning shots at Iranian boats near the Persian Gulf. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Could a magic mushroom help relieve illness-driven anxiety or depression in those suffering from cancer? According to a recently released small double-blind study published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology, the answer is yes. Researchers say they found cancer patients were able to find considerable relief from illness-related depression or anxiety for up to 6 months with one large dose of the compound psilocybin found in hallucinogenic mushrooms. While just a single dose of the compound produced hallucinogenic effects in patients for about 4 to 6 hours, researchers also found that one dose produced a drop in depression and anxiety that lasted for 6 months. Patients also reported that the compound left them more optimistic and increased their quality of life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear about the challenges of being a working mother in the music business. British lawmakers are debating legislation similar to the Magnitsky Act in the United States, which allows courts to impose visa bans and asset freezes on Russian officials allegedly involved in the 2009 death of lawyer Sergei Magnitsky. The U.S. Act has been widened to include anyone accused of human rights abuses. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, pressure is now growing for other European countries to follow suit.
Lawyer Sergei Magnitsky died in a Moscow jail in 2009 after spending almost a year behind bars without facing trial. He had been charged with conspiracy, but his supporters say he was targeted by the Russian state after uncovering a $230 million fraud by senior officials using subsidiaries of the investment fund Hermitage Capital. An independent investigation concluded he had been tortured by 8 prison guards on the day of his death. No one has been convicted. Hermitage Capital CEO Bill Browder fought successfully to have the Magnitsky Act signed into US law, targeting those involved in the fraud and in Sergei Magnitsky's death. Now, Browder is fighting to have similar legislation adopted in Britain and told VOA he is optimistic.
All the indications are that we have an extremely robust group of cross-party support from all the major parties.
Browder says Moscow's actions in Ukraine and Syria are helping his cause.
The behavior of Russia in the last 2 years has become so egregious that it's become possible even to convince the executive branch this is the right thing to do.
The proposal for a British Magnitsky law is being debated as an amendment to a wider piece of legislation called the Criminal Finances Bill. Andrew Foxall is head of the Russia program at analyst group the Henry Jackson Society.
What it seeks to do is broaden out the scope of Magnitsky-related legislation to take in a far more global context.
Anyone could seek an asset freeze under the proposed legislation, making it a powerful tool, says Browder.
Private parties, NGOs, can go to the court with pro bono lawyers and could go after bad guys and get a court designation completely irrespective of the government.
London is a favourite second home for many oligarchs from Russia and former Soviet states, some of whom are accused of rights abuses and corruption. Again, Andrew Foxall.
The National Crime Agency, of course, suggests that well in excess of £100 billion annually of corrupt money flows through the UK.
Lawmakers are due to vote on the amendment in the coming weeks. Supporters hope its passing could pressure the European Union to adopt similar laws. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Speaking to French media, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said his forces are on the road to victory following last month's capture of rebel-held Aleppo. Mr. Assad said he doesn't consider the retaking of Aleppo as a victory. The victory, he said, will be achieved when you get rid of all the terrorists, a reference to rebels seeking to topple his regime. He said Aleppo was a tipping point in the course of the war. In an excerpt carried by the French press agency ahead of the broadcast Monday, the Syrian leader lamented the suffering of the Syrian people caused by the conflict.
Every war is bad. Why bad? Because every war is about destruction. Every war is about the killing. That's why every war is bad. You cannot say this is a good war, even if it's for good reason, to defend your country for noble reason. But it's bad. That's why it's not the solution.
Assad defended the bombardment of eastern Aleppo as part of the process of liberating the Syrian people from the control of terrorists. Analyst David Lesh, a history professor at Trinity University in Texas, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that while Damascus is winning, the nearly six-year conflict is far from over.
There are a number of different conflicts going on in Syria right now, but the regime does control the major cities, and the majority of the population is living under regime-controlled areas. So, you know, they are winning, they have not won. But then you have to consider, you know, is it a Pyrrhic victory when 500,000 are dead and 85% of the country is living in poverty, when diseases that once were under control are now running rampant again, when there's 58% unemployment, when, you know, life expectancy has dropped by 15 years, when almost 50% of the child-age population are not in school, so a lost generation in the making, and then you have, you know, anywhere between $250 and $400 billion of reconstruction to do that they're going to need to get the international community, which in no way wants to reward Assad for his part in all of this.
In speaking with French lawmakers, Mr. Assad said he was optimistic about new peace talks scheduled later this month in Kazakhstan. He said he's ready for reconciliation with the other side on condition they lay down their arms.
The Assad government always said the right things because, you know, they expect them to fail. They don't want to seem to be obstructionists. They don't want to seem to be the ones that torpedo any talks. But, you know, if they make serious movement toward concessions by the Syrian government, then we'll know whether or not President Assad means what he says. But for the time being, I think, as in past cases, they're banking on them to fail. And then they can go on with what they, you know, I suspect they think will be cleanup activities and trying to gain control of remaining pockets of areas in Syria that are under opposition control.
That's David Lesh of Trinity University. He said ongoing fighting in the Wadi Barada Valley near the capital underscores the government's objective of seizing vital territory around Damascus while leaving rebel-held Idlib to the north as an opposition safe haven until such time it too can be retaken. Well, the staple grain of Ethiopia is sprouting across America as teff is set to overtake quinoa and other ancient grains as the new substitute for gluten-free and protein-rich products. Faith Lapidus reports.
Americans were usually introduced to teff at Ethiopian restaurants, where it's the main ingredient in injera, the spongy flatbread used as an edible serving plate. But American consumers at the grocery store are interested in the grain's nutritional value. It's high in protein, vitamin C, calcium, and fiber. And it's gluten-free, making it an attractive alternative to wheat.
Well, the popularity has been increasing recently, mainly because it's gluten-free grain, and that's very popular at the moment. You're finding it more in its whole grain form, in its flour form, in tortillas and things like that. So people are cooking with it a lot more. It's being more utilized in baking and things like that.
Nutritionist Alyssa Goodman says there's a good reason for that.
I think that all of us are a little tired of quinoa. We have had quinoa in everything, so I think we're ready for a change. And teff is a gluten-free grain. It's been around for a very, very long time. And I have to tell you, there are a lot of benefits compared to its counterparts of gluten-free grains that excel.
Sales of traditional grains have risen in the United States, with teff sales up 58% in 2014, according to a market research report. And the National Restaurant Association called ancient grains a top food trend for 2017, all of which is good news for this tiny, powerful upstart in the American diet. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Balancing work and family is a challenge for any mom, but when you're a professional musician, the stresses can be overwhelming. But as International Edition's David Byrd tells us, some moms are finding a way to balance the demands of family and a public career.
Rhiannon Giddens, the lead singer of the Grammy-winning Carolina Chocolate Drops, knows about balancing life and work. Between recording her new album, due out next month, and a recurring role on the TV show Nashville, Giddens has to split her time between work in the United States and home in Ireland, where her husband and two children live. Giddens, a biracial multi-instrumentalist, grew up in Greensboro, North Carolina. She married Irish musician Michael Laffin in 2007, and he still lives in Limerick. But Giddens says that she believes it's important that her children be exposed to their father's homeland as much as to hers.
So even if we don't keep doing this forever, it's like they're at least getting a really good chunk of what it means to be Irish, because they're going to get what it means to be American, and they've already gotten loads of what it means to be North Carolinian, and, you know, and I don't know how the race thing is going to play out. You know, my daughter's already kind of, you know, noticing the difference in the skin tone, and I took her to the African American Museum, and it was just like a whole nother, you know, it's just, I don't know how that's going to play out, but all I know is I'm trying to get them, you know, the cultures that they come from.
Singer-songwriter Caitlin Smith has written for Garth Brooks and released her latest EP, Starfire, last July. She is also a new mom to an infant son. She says that she is still figuring out how to balance work and home.
Yeah, it's definitely an adjustment. You know, I just started going back on the road and trying to figure out how to do road life, and babies is a different challenge, but we're figuring it out, and he's a good baby, so it makes it easy.
Jamie Lynn Spears had her daughter Maddie when she was only 16 years old. Since then, she has been working in Nashville and released her EP, The Journey, in 2014. She says she looks to other moms in Music City for help and inspiration.
So it's so nice to look at other women and kind of, you know that you're not alone. Even though we might have different stories from different places, we're all there doing the same thing, chasing the same dream. So I look at other women up there doing what I'm doing, and I'm like, you know what, if they can do it, I can do it. So it's always a great reminder to, you know, hear other women feel the same way you feel.
I can't carry the weight of this war.
Joy Williams knows the demands of life on the road. After leaving the Grammy-winning duo The Civil Wars, Williams re-released her 2015 album Venus as an acoustic CD. She says that now she wants to focus on what's truly important, her family and friends.
I love my family and I love my friends, and I want to be creative and do things that I love in a way where I can still be present for the people that I love too.
Williams says she has toured to the point of not remembering her own last name. But now, when you click on her website under Tour, it reads, "There are no upcoming tour dates." In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks very much, David. Well, there is an anniversary coming up that's really quite astounding. Smartphones are everywhere, so it's hard to believe the iconic iPhone from Apple was launched just 10 years ago today. That day, Apple co-founder Steve Jobs took the stage at Macworld 2007 to introduce what he called three products in one: a widescreen iPod with touch controls, a revolutionary mobile phone, and a breakthrough internet communications device. Apple has sold more than 1 billion iPhones since then, changing the way we communicate, take pictures, listen to music, watch videos, and keep in touch with loved ones, just to name a few. Tim Cook, Apple's CEO, says iPhone is an essential part of our customers' lives, and today more than ever, it's redefining the way we communicate, entertain, work, and live. Currently, Apple is selling the seventh edition of the smartphone, iPhone 7, and a larger version, the iPhone 7 Plus. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, will provide $227.3 million in additional development assistance to support the five-year, $2.3 billion agreement signed with the Nigerian government in 2015. The aid package brings the total provided under the agreement to $702 million. The new funding will continue to help Nigeria reduce extreme poverty by stimulating economic growth, promoting a healthier, more educated population, and strengthening good governance. We are pleased to announce new funding under the agreement signed with the Nigerian government in 2015 to provide better access to education and health services and promote democracy and economic growth, said U.S. Ambassador Stuart Symington. With the Nigerian government's leadership, we know this funding will significantly improve the well-being of Nigerians, he added. In addition to development assistance funding, the United States is providing humanitarian aid to people affected by the ongoing conflict and severe food insecurity in northeastern Nigeria and throughout the Lake Chad Basin. The United States has provided more than $291 million in humanitarian assistance since fiscal year 2016 and continues to be the single largest bilateral humanitarian donor to the region. USAID partners to end extreme poverty and promote resilient, democratic societies while advancing American security and prosperity. In its partnership with Nigeria, the United States strengthens social stability through social services, supports transparent and accountable governance, promotes a more market-led economy, and enhances Nigeria's capacity as a responsible regional and trade partner. The United States is proud to work with Nigeria to promote the prosperity of the people of Nigeria and the African region.